Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting of Senate Finance to order. Today's Friday, June 11th, 1:30 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Members present today, Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Olson in Anchorage, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Von Emhoff, and Senator Wilson. Senator Hoffman is away on other states' business, and myself, Senator Bishop. And I'd like to do a mic check in Anchorage. I thought Senator Von Emhoff was there. Did she leave, Senator Wilikowski?
Here. Yeah, this is Bill Wilikowski. Senator Von Emhoff is here as well.
Here.
Thank you. Could you turn the volume up so we can hear him in Anchorage, please? Okay, mic check in Anchorage again.
Yeah, this is Bill Wilikowski.
This is Natasha.
Okay, we're having a little trouble hearing you here. We got the mic volume all the way up, but we will make sure we get your questions asked.
We'll try to fix it on our end. We're just going to right.
Sounds like a Grateful Dead concert. Okay, today's agenda, SJR 6, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund and Permanent Fund Dividends. SJR 6 is the first hearing. Our intention is to hear a resolution introduction, sectional analysis, and from the administration, and have a presentation from Legislative Finance later in the day. Today's introduction will be done by Commissioner Mahoney, Director, Commissioner of Department of Revenue, her Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Barnhill, Mr. Steininger, Director of OMB, Corey Mills, Director, Deputy Director, Attorney General, and sectional analysis walkthrough will be done by Mr. Milks. And let's see, Emily Nauman, Ledge Legal, Alexi Painter. So with that, Commissioner, good afternoon. And I see that you were in Fairbanks yesterday, and I just want to get a weather report from up there, and then did the people treat you right in Fairbanks? And I also want to recognize the Senate President and the Majority Whip, Senator Machicki and Senator Mia Costello. And have I missed any Senator Rivak? I think everybody's been accounted for. Good, thank you. Commissioner, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bishop and members of the committee. And to provide you with an update of the weather report in Fairbanks yesterday. Actually, my trip there was quite delightful, and it was sunny and cloudy, and everybody there was very welcoming. It was a really wonderful trip. So thank you for inquiring. So my name is Lucinda Mahoney. I am the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And I am here today to provide you with information about the governor's comprehensive fiscal plan, SJR 6, which is one of the amendments that provides the framework for that, which specifically address the permanent fund, the permanent fund dividends, as well as the power cost equalization program. The governor has developed a structured, disciplined fiscal plan that will protect the permanent fund. The permanent fund dividend would be enshrined into the Constitution, as well as the power cost equalization fund. And it protects these three items into the future for future generations. It provides a fair sharing of the wealth of our natural resources that Alaskans have earned and owned over time by allocating the POMV on a 50-50 basis. We estimate that with a $3 billion draw from the ERA and the generation of $300 million in additional revenues, that in the 24-25 timeframe, that will position us to a balanced budget within 5 years.
So this. I'd like to just make one comment before. I'll look at the table and in Anchorage at the end of each slide to see if we have questions. We'd like to ask questions at the end of the slide if so we don't get get behind. Thank you.
Sure. So the governor's goals with this specific amendment is to protect the PERM fund and, as I indicated, enshrine the permanent fund dividend into the Constitution. It is to establish a consistent PFD with a formula that is reliable, that government can count on, as well as Alaskans in regard to their dividend. Another key component, another goal of the plan is to establish a strong reserve base. And this will be to provide a cushion for the unknown events that will impact our financials in the future. And then lastly, a goal to get to the point where we have a sustainable, balanced budget.
Thank you. Seeing no questions at this point, please continue.
So here we are. We are in the first special session that was called by the governor, which was to first complete the operating budget, but also to address the first phase of a multi-phased approach to fix some structural change, some structural challenges that we have here at the state. So the permanent fund fix would move the permanent fund more to an endowment mode, and we are recommending, or the governor's amendment is, that the power cost equalization fund become protected and be deposited into the permanent fund. The goal is also to establish and get everyone to recognize that one of the key components of this plan is to establish strong reserves, which include a one-time draw from the ERA that we are referring to as bridge funding. And then also this session, the goal of the governor is to establish consensus on what is our deficit size. You know, we all talk about wanting to achieve fiscal sustainability, but until we really land on our specific targets in terms of, you know, what spending level should we be at, what is the size of the dividend, it's difficult to determine what revenues are needed to support that. So the objective was to discuss that in this session. Session two is intended to then further the multi-phased approach and to discuss the revenue initiatives or revenue measures that would be required to achieve a balanced budget in the future, as well as reductions to the operating budget. So this was the structure that the governor has laid out.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Steadman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, we've got a process here we're going to go through, so some of these questions may fit in, you know, later, but, and I might bring them up later to surface them now. But as far as a stepped plan going forward, which I think we're going to have to do to get to a solution, it's not going to be a, you know, one operation fixes everything. But clearly, step one, we're not going to be successful at, because we're going to be adjourning here next week, and there's a lot of work to be done here. So the steps or phases that are presented here, I think as we go forward, it would be nice to have Department of Revenue come back with more specific structure in their phases, and we'll get into that in more detail later when we get into the budget. But there's clear concern over the timing of some of these events, the timing of if we're going to have taxes, you know, when are they needed, if we're going to overdraw the permanent fund, when is that going to be required, and it's a whole nother discussion on here on what, if anything, is going to be attached into the Constitution. Clearly there's been discussions with the power cost equalization, but there's also education, public safety, capital budgets, all kinds of things that people want constitutionally protected. So we've got quite a process, Mr. Chairman, to work through here.
Thank you. Anchorage, is are you guys good for now?
I'm okay. Thank you.
Yep. All right. Good. Okay. Page four.
So the first component of the governor's plan is to modernize the PERM fund from a trust to a true endowment. And this is an internationally accepted best practice. And as you have likely heard from the executive director, Ms. Riddell, this is also a component of the governor's plan that the trustees do support. The annual distribution of the plan would be limited to 5 years, or 5% of the average of the last 5 years of the PERM fund ending value. And then the 5% would then be equally split between dividends and government services. So what this plan does then is it stabilizes the revenues and the dividends and enables improved planning for both government as well as for citizens in regard to the size of the dividend as well as the size of government. And then additionally, a part of this plan is to deposit the power cost equalization fund into the principal of the permanent fund. Currently, this balance is $1.1 billion. And these actions would then constitutionally protect both the permanent fund as well as the PCE for future generations. And just as a side note, the Alaska Energy Authority manages the PCE currently, and they did put forward a resolution from their board supporting this movement in regard to the PCE.
Questions? Senator Stubman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like a little further definition on why it's 5% and how it's created, and is that a suitable percentage? I know it's currently in the statute form, and I understand that, but the projections that we've seen here at the table from Cowan and Associates, the consultants of the permanent fund, along with our retirement plans, they're actually lowering their rate of return going forward for the next decade. And I just would like to have some discussion on why this is five, why it's not six, or why it's not four, or some other number.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Stedman, that is a great question. And Mr. Barnhill, our deputy commissioner of the Department of Revenue, has studied that, and I'm going to invite him to the table to respond to that question.
We'll take a brief at ease while we get...
We can...
The record, Mr. Barnhill, put yourself on the record and you heard the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Unlike the way I usually do things with long, rambling answers, I'll give you a short response and then a longer one if you'd like it. So through the chair, Senator Stedman, with respect to the 5% distribution rate, and that's 5% multiplied by the lagging five-year average market value of the permanent fund, CEO Riddell testified recently that the trustees continue to support that 5% number and supported it being placed in the Constitution. Now, the longer answer. Senator Stedman is correct that there's been a lot of discussion and analysis, both in the state of Alaska as well as elsewhere, as to whether 5% is the right number going forward. The concern is that for the past few years, we've been at the top of a bull market, started in 2009, and Cowan's concern, as well as other investment advisors, is that bull market may not persist going into the next 10 years. Last year, of course, we had a brief market crash with a very rapid recovery, and of course, this year we're experiencing phenomenal returns. The concern of investment advisors right now is that those phenomenal returns are possibly pulling returns from the future forward. And then once we get through this enthusiasm in the market, that we may not see real returns in the 5% range for, you know, some period of time. At this point in time, given the phenomenal returns, we think it's premature to consider reducing that 5% rate. And understand, too, just for the public, when you take 5%, you multiply it by a lagging five-year average, your effective rate is going to be less than 5%. And Ms. Rodell has put those numbers on the table. It's somewhere in the range of 4.5% to 4.75% each year. As long as our real returns are in excess of that draw rate, we're going to protect the fund from inflation because the fund's going to grow at the rate of inflation. It remains a absolutely pertinent issue, and one of the ways we've proposed to address that is by inserting the language before 5%, not more than 5%. And this gives discretion to the legislature to appropriate less than 5% of the lagging five-year market average. And I would anticipate if this gets into the Constitution that a variety of advisors will come regularly and report on whether the proposed draw percentage is consistent with sustainably managing the fund.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in retrospect, I think several years ago we went to a percent of market value, and at that time we were out at 5.25 for several years and then down to 5, and it was my opinion, it was set at the maximum draw rate that can be maintained with little to no margin left. So my concern I have today is when you look at the forecast of lower rates of return, when we have for the next decade, and this is going to go on for, you know, in hopefully perpetuity, when you have a draw rate as set at 5%, it basically takes all the growth out of the fund other than what we're going to be able to be depositing back into it to make it grow. And it gives you no or little margin of error for economic times that aren't as robust as in the past. And clearly returns regress to the mean. And we've been way above average returns lately. So we're going to have years where we're going to have lower returns. And I think, Mr. Chairman, before we set this rate as we work through this process, we need to have some presentations from the consultants along with the permanent fund, because my concern is that the legislature would set the rate to maximize the outflow of the permanent fund and diminish in that discussion the concern over growing the permanent fund over time and protecting it from adverse negative markets. So I'm a little uncomfortable with locking in perpetuity a rate that gives us no margin at all. I think we need to review that overall pay out percentage. I recognize that the effective or the arithmetic one-year rate is different than the geometric rate over several years with smoothing, but we use the geometric return rates going forward. We don't use the aromatic one-year rates, so we can't mix the two up. So I think we need to take a look at that, see what it looks like at 4.5%, see what it looks like at 4.75%, see what it looks like at 5%, and then make that as a decision for the best interest of the permanent fund, not the best interest of cash generation to the spending appetite of the legislature.
Thank you. Other questions from committee members in Anchorage?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do understand and respect the co-chair's concern about the 5% rate, but to me, at this time, that seems to be more of an academic exercise, and it seems to also be sort of a cart in front of the horse, because we have such a far path to go to create this plan the governor is proposing, that just putting the rate in the Constitution is probably one of the last things that we'll do. And I also think it's there's bigger issues of taking 50% of the POMB draw, whatever that draw is, 5.25, 5, 4.75, 4.5, taking 50% of that to give to dividends will yield more than $1 billion in a deficit. And to me, that is the bigger question, and that is the more concerning and more alarming and more immediate factor, because trying to fill that with a series and a combination of sales tax and income taxes will have much far-reaching impacts and ramifications to the economy than at this juncture arguing over what the rate should be. And my last comment is, Mr. Bill, our Deputy Commissioner Bill Hart,
Barnhill.
The title. Just by having it up to 5% does give the legislature flexibility, and I do appreciate that. Thank you.
Other questions? I've got one. If there's any other questions at the table? On Commissioner, if the PCE fund is deposited into the permanent fund and its earnings are used on the 50-50 dividend calculation, does that mean half of the PCE fund earnings will go towards PFDs?
Mr. Chairman, the intent is that the PCE is deposited into the PERM fund and it becomes a part of the PERM fund. So to the extent that this formula that is being proposed by the governor is used, then that component that was deposited as a part of the total then would be subject to the 50-50.
50-50 to PCE and 50-50 to dividends.
Right, but in terms of the total of the PERM fund.
Okay. Continue. If there's no further questions, we'll go to the next slide.
The graph that you see on the right represents the historical permanent fund dividends that have been paid since inception, beginning in 1982. And what you see in regard to the green line represents the statutory calculation of the PFD. As you look up towards the right of the slide, you can see where there is a red line that goes lower than the green line going up. And that is a representation of the diverging from the statute that occurred in the determination of the dividend amount. So what the governor is proposing is the dashed line that you see in the middle. So he has come down, if you will, quite a long way from supporting the statutory dividend amount to meet folks more in the middle. And so that is the line that is represented there. So as you all in this room know, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about the dividend. You know, some people support a full statutory dividend, some support no dividend at all. But the whole conversation around the dividend just seems to create mistrust somewhat in our communities, in that some think that we're spending too much on government and not enough on dividend. And it results in just a lot of conversation surrounding the dividend. So the governor really wants to fix this structural problem, establish the dividend in a formula that is followed, restore trust with the public, and establish his philosophy of a fair split of the permanent fund earnings, which is 50-50. And his proposal is to constitutionalize the dividend payment.
Senator Olson, did you have a question?
No, actually I did not, sorry.
I'd just like to touch on that just for a moment on your comments. You know, as far as public mistrust, you know, the public, they don't have all the information we have. And there's members sitting at this table, including the governor, when he sat at this table, we moved $4.9 billion into the permanent fund, into the corpus, to protect it for future generations of Alaskans. And we've got another transfer in front of this conference committee now to transfer another $4 billion. And that doesn't count the $7 billion that we've transferred in years past, plus the state has never taken any of their earnings off of the permanent fund until we started the POMV draw. So we are really wanting to protect the fund. I think our actions show that, so future generations can get a permanent fund dividend check. So thank you. Any other questions? Senator Steadman.
So back when the permanent fund first started, the asset allocation was substantially different. Maybe we can, one of the two presenters could talk a little bit about that concept and the dividend payout. And then we converted it to a percent of market value, and over that time, the asset allocation substantially changed. But in the beginning, roughly 35, 40 years, what have you, the 50% that was 100%, 50 to go to dividends, 50 was to go to the state. The state reinvested their 50%. 30, 35 years, maybe longer. A substantial amount of time. Never drew a dime out of it of any significance. So could you maybe talk a little bit about that? And I would like, when we come back and visit this, to actually have that parsed out. I'd like to see what the permanent fund would actually be, if this in dollar amount, roughly, and you know, it's not going to be precise, but I think we can get it in the ballpark range of reasonableness, due to the fact that the state had reinvested their 50%, substantially growing the value of the permanent fund and substantially increasing the dividend payout. And it's not talked about or recognized, but it's substantial. So if you could, one of the two, you can help us with that a little bit, and then we'll come back later in a future date and go into it in quite detail.
Through the chair, Mike Barnhill. Senator Steadman, I can give you some quick history, and a lot of this is detailed in slides that Ms. Rodell has recently presented at various hearings in the legislature. The first permanent fund statute was enacted in 1980, and it limited investments of permanent fund assets to fixed income. Unfortunately, in 1980, the interest rates were skyrocketing, and the permanent fund trustees were concerned about eroding principal value with rates going up, and so they requested that they be given permission to invest in equities. Also in 1980, the only cash that went out of the permanent fund was just cash. It was coupons and dividends. There was no transfer of realized capital gains from sale of assets. Those are all retained in principle. In 1982, the legislature amended the statute, and that was when capital gains, net realized capital gains, could move to what was then called the undistributed income account. With that came the understanding that anything that went in the form of capital gains would potentially erode the inflation-adjusted value of the assets, and so provision was made for inflation-proofing adjustment, an appropriation back. So we started doing inflation proofing in 1982. Over the time period 1982 to 2006, the legislature gradually gave the permanent fund more latitude in terms of the things that it could invest in. But there was always a legal list, which is common practice in investment management up until, you know, the early 2000s. And at that point, more and more institutional funds began discarding their legal lists and going for the prudent investor rule, which is basically you can invest in anything as long as it's prudent. In 2006, the legislature enacted the prudent investment rule, and since then, the permanent fund has had essentially full discretion to invest in anything it determines as prudent. There still is a legal list requirement. It's just the permanent fund must do that in regulation. Since 1982, there's always been an inflation until recently, an inflation appropriation back to the permanent fund in order to make sure that the permanent fund principal keeps up with inflation. Starting in 2018, with the enactment of SB 26, we almost converted to a full endowment. And in an endowment methodology, there isn't two accounts, there's one account, and inflation is managed through the distribution percentage. So as long as that distribution percentage is set at or greater than, so long as it's set at what you expect to be the real return, and you spend your real return, you're keeping inflation in the corpus of the permanent fund. Right now we have both methodologies. We have a statutory inflation adjustment methodology where we appropriate back to the principal, as the chair indicated. We sort of forward-funded inflation proofing through that $4.9 billion. But we also have this distribution percentage, which is intended to manage inflation as well.
Follow-up?
You didn't hit on the one significant point here, and that is the state not taking its 50% out, the other 50% going to dividends for roughly pushing 38 years, reinvesting that money in the portfolio, substantially increased the value of the portfolio, thereby increasing year by year the dividends being paid to the people. So when we have come back and have this parsed out, either by the Department of Revenue or the Permanent Fund or some combo with the two of you, I'd like to see what the Permanent Fund would be if we actually followed that intent, where the state took out their 50%, parked it, spent it, whatever. And what would that dividend stream look like? Because the dividend stream that we're seeing here on this chart is grossly distorted by the policy call that the legislature made not to take their 50%, but to reinvest it. Thereby, the other party, the individual citizens for their dividend, reaped excess reward for our good behavior. And if we're going to look at resetting this, we need to factor that in the equation when we have the discussion here at the table. Because it's probably going to be somewhere about half of what the dividend is today is what I'm expecting that number to look like. We've seen some preliminary numbers a couple years ago, but we can put a finer point on it with some help.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stedman, we can certainly bring back any data that you'd like to see. I'm going to quibble just a bit with the notion that the 50% ex dividends was for the state, because the legislature intended that some portion of that 50%, the first call would be to do inflation proofing. But to your point, there was excess after inflation proofing that the state never appropriated for another purpose. And that allowed, in real terms, for the permanent fund to grow over time. And so your point is absolutely correct, that when you begin to appropriate the full amount of real return going forward, that net real growth will be reduced, if not eliminated, and you will simply keep up with inflation.
Senator Wilikowski, then Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just trying to line up these numbers here, and as I understand it, under this proposal, the dividend in 2021 would be $2,354. And what would the statutory dividend be? Is it the 3,064 number, or is it a different number?
Commissioner?
Yes, through the chair. The dividend would be $2,354 in fiscal year 22, and the statutory amount would be $3,064.
Just follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So in order to bridge the gap from $2,354 under this plan to the statutory plan of $3,064, how much are we talking about in terms of straight dollar amount from the earnings reserve? Is that about $700 million or so, billion dollars?
Yeah. Through the chair, that sounds about right, Mr. Senator.
Did you hear the answers?
$700 million, is that the number?
Through the chair, Mike Barnhill. So I tripped over this the other day. The appropriation for 50-50 dividends is about $1.5 billion. And currently, the permanent fund is estimating that the appropriation for statutory dividends, and this changes every month, and we won't know for certain until the permanent fund closes the books on FY21. But in their most recent projection, they're estimating $2.3 billion for statutory dividends. So it's closer to $800 million, but it's somewhere between $700 million and $800 million. And we won't know with any certainty until the books are closed on FY21.
Just one last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
So it's $800 million delta there. My understanding is the projected amount for deductible oil tax credits is $762 million. Does that sound about right?
Through the chair, that's correct. In total and approximate, yeah.
And so if you eliminated the deductible oil tax credits, you'd have enough to pay the full statutory dividend, correct?
I didn't hear him. Did you hear him?
Is it enough to pay?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I guess if you chose to pay it off all at once, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff?
Thank you. So I just wanted to address the inflation comment. Inflation, as long as it's not removed from the fund, whether it's in the earnings reserve account or whether it's in the corpus, is irrelevant. The fund is invested as a whole at this time and has been, and so the inflation is being invested just like it was, whether it's in the corpus or the earnings reserve account, and the fund has grown accordingly and has been invested accordingly, and inflation has been included the entire time. The reason to move inflation from the earnings reserve account into the corpus is that the legislature doesn't have the ability to withdraw the inflation from the, or whatever the inflated earnings of that year in the, from the earnings reserve account. So to say that the fund would be less or more because we have not moved inflation is not accurate. Secondly, the legislature has also added, I think, nearly $7 billion, and hopefully the Department of Revenue or the Permanent Fund will know the exact amount, in ad hoc deposits into the fund over the last several years, and those have been invested as well. And so the earnings off of those amounts, should they be excluded as part of the, you know, dividend calculation at this point? So those are different things and philosophical questions that we also need to grapple with. Thank you.
I'd like to recognize the co-chair of House Finance, Representative Kelly Merricks, joined us in the finance room. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious why, so during the ballot measure one oil tax debate, the governor opposed that and said it should be addressed in the legislature. He said that you'd get a better process if it's done in the legislature. I haven't seen any bills on the Department of Revenue's part or on the governor's part to fix the oil tax structure, to get rid of the $800 million in oil tax credits. And I'm just curious, why hasn't he proposed anything? Instead of cutting the people's dividend, why hasn't he proposed eliminating any oil tax credits?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, for 2022, the governor did incorporate payment of the annual statutory amount for the tax credits.
Senator Stedman?
Just a point of clarification, I think, from following this conversation. The $114 million that's put in the proposed budget by the governor is to pay a liability on the books of $730 million or so, some number. That's a sunk cost. So we got to work through that schedule and get that paid off. So I think we need to parse the liability from previous credits that were created and put against the Treasury, compared to what's coming at the Treasury in the future, today and in the future. I think that to Senator Wilikowski's point, there's a per barrel credit that's an ongoing issue when we're in the profit side of the severance tax. I think the liability issue of the 730 some odd million or 20, whatever it is a little different issue.
Next slide, if we're done with this one.
Okay, the objective of this slide is to just communicate some of the points associated with the need for consistency in regard to the PFD. Alaskans, particularly those who rely on the dividend for basic needs, really deserve some certainty to the extent that it's possible in regard to their dividend amount. The state, it would be so much more sustainable if we had a formula in place where we could establish some consistency such that we could do some better planning. And without identifying these formulaic type situations, it's extremely difficult for us to identify what would be needed in the future for additional revenues or additional reductions, because otherwise, if we don't settle on these amounts, we could result in either over or under collecting or over or under potentially taxing Alaskans. The governor's philosophy is that the 50% POMV distribution between dividends as well as governments is a fair and equitable distribution of Alaska's wealth between its citizens and its government. Also, what would be really important about resolving this issue, in addition to establishing some fiscal structure, would be to really redirect the conversation of the legislature as well as the governor in terms of really talking about economic growth, diversifying our economy, and focusing on other areas in our state versus frequently spending so much time just debating the PFD.
Questions? I just have one. As tight as our cash flow is, then would it be better served to take $1 billion a year draw on your bridge funding here? Wouldn't it earn more leaving it in the whole fund and take it out $1 billion at a time instead of taking it all out and putting it in the CBR and with a less rate of return?
Mr. Chairman, while we are requesting a $3 billion bridge to solve the fiscal problem, the intent would be, in regard to the actual draws, the actual cash movement that would move between the ERA and the CBR, that is something that we would work with the Perm Fund organization on, and we could draw it as needed such that those dollars would be able to earn the highest amount of return as possible by remaining invested in the permanent fund.
Thank you, Commissioner. Further questions on this slide? Seeing none, next slide.
So here the objective is to talk about the bridge funding that has been proposed by the governor to enable the fiscal plan. And he is proposing that we do a one-time draw from the ERA to the CBR, and this amount would be $3 billion. However, I would like to point out that with the deposit of the PCE of $1.1 billion into the permanent fund, the net draw or the net reduction to the permanent fund would in fact be $1.9 billion. But this bridge funding, in combination with revenue measures of $300 million, as well as potential spending reductions, really positions the state to fix this problem. You know, as we developed these models and developed this proposal, we did look around to other endowments to see, is this a practice, particularly considering where we are with COVID and coming out of COVID and some of the fiscal challenges organizations have faced. Is this something that other endowments have been doing? And so Mr. Barnhill did do some research in regard to that, and I would like for him to share that now, if it's okay with the chair.
Does anybody have any questions of the commissioner before Mr. Barnhill gives us a tutorial? Seeing Senator Wilson, you had a question.
I just have a question here on the second bullet. Is it $300 million or $500 million total that would be needed to sort of bridge us through to FY 25, 26? think there were some different numbers that folks had a question on in other presentations throughout this building. So I just wanted to get that clarification on the record. What's our total sort of gap?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the $300 million was developed based on the 10-year fiscal plan that was submitted as a part of the budget. And so the 10-year fiscal plan had incorporated $200 million in reductions to the operating budget in period 23 and 24. So from when we were developing this model, we assumed that those reductions were already a given. We assumed that that was a document that was read. However, through this process, we've learned that some folks didn't realize that. So it depends on how you look at it. From our perspective, particularly mine, as I was looking at it, I assumed that that was understood. And then when we developed what was needed in terms of going forward, our model, based on the governor's philosophy in terms of his policy decisions, recognized that we would need an additional $300 million in revenues or reductions over what had been previously presented in the 10-year plan.
And if I could
follow up, sir.
Follow up. Then if this, you know, and I guess this goes to the, this plan avoids the need for a broad-based tax. And if we can't get the reductions, and if we do have to get a broad-based tax, given the workforce in Alaska, each working person in Alaska would end up paying about $2,100 on the high end to fill that gap?
Through the chair, Mr. Wilson, I'm not familiar with the $2,100.
I'm just saying that that's the average that each Alaskan would have to pay to fill the $500 million gap within the budget if we don't get the reductions and if we don't have another plan that would avoid a broad-based tax, that broad-based tax, either sales tax or income tax, would, or a combination of thereof, would equal on the high end about $2,100 for each working Alaskan in the state. Low end case would be about $1,300 in order for them to get a $2,300 dividend. Would that be accurate, roundabout numbers?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the governor does not, the governor's plan does not incorporate a broad-based tax of any sort. And so we have not done calculations like you are suggesting, because the governor's plan assumes a different approach to reducing the gap.
When will you be ready to share that?
The objective is that those discussions will occur in the special session beginning in August.
Thank you for that answer. Senator Stedman.
I look at the $3 billion as a raid on the permanent fund. Clean and simple. Call it bridge funding. Just call anything you want. But clearly, it breaches the spending cap we have now at 5%. We have in place a statutory spending cap allowing only a draw of 5% out of the permanent fund, and we're up against it today. So I'm cautious about overdrawing the permanent fund, to say the least, because when you take $3 billion out of the permanent fund, you don't take it out for 1 year. You take it out for perpetuity. You take it out for the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of ours. So I think we should be very careful about overdrawing the permanent fund for any reason at all, particularly one for just implementing a fiscal policy. So, Mr. Chairman, when we come forward and work on this in the future, and I know there's some work coming up here on the presentation, but I'd like to take a good look at what's the opportunity cost to future Alaskans on $3 billion. And frankly, I don't care, you know, if they take $3 billion and spend it on salaries, or they take $3 billion in bridge funding, or they take $3 billion and flush it down the toilet. It's gone. So we need to be very protective of the permanent fund, and I would like to remind the Finance Committee, this very committee at this very table, we saved billions of dollars in the CBR, billions, amount that was staggering. and we spent it over the last several years. And once you open the door to the permanent fund, it's the next time, it's an easier vote and an easier vote and an easier vote. So I'm very cautious of this, Mr. Chairman, as far as implementing taxes. I understand the, I understand the presenter, there's no broad-based tax going to come forward from the administration. They have other ideas, so we'll wait and see what their other ideas are. So I'm, we'll have to, I guess, wait and see on that. As far as budgetary reductions, we haven't reduced the operating budget since the second year of Governor Walker. Now, we've reduced it a little bit here, and we reduced it a little bit there, and it's been increased here, and it's been increased there. For all practical purposes, it's flat spending on our agencies, including the judiciary, the legislature, and the governors. And it would include statewide debt service and retirement plans. We've gained on some issues, lost on others. This table has struggled for the last 3 months on the operating budget. The operating budget that's going to be, that is coming to a final vote, is pretty much flat for all practical purposes. We'll be down a little bit. We'll probably have a little supplemental, and we're going to be flat. So the last year of Governor Walker was the 29th legislature. Then we went through the 30th legislature, and then we got a new governor, Governor Dunleavy. And we had the 31st legislature. And now we're finishing up the first year in the 32nd legislature. And I'd like to see where these reductions are, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to see in the layout by department for the next 5 years, including debt service, fund capitalization, and retirement payments. Because I don't believe it. I don't believe it's going to materialize. We have spent hours in the conference committee. We were dickering on $16,000 back and forth in the conference committee. $16,000. And you're not going to cut $500 million out of this budget in any way, shape, or form, or it would have been done by a previous legislatures or the current governor or the previous governor. So, you know, I think we need to have a shot of reality here on what is movable and doable and how we're going to fix this going forward. But for those that think that we're going to go in and collect budget reductions out of the university and out of the Marine Highway, as an example, we did 2 years ago, that was all added back with retirement payments and the Department of Corrections. We netted zero. So I want to see what the proposed revenue sources are. I'm not excited about taxes. I'm not interested in tax and spend. I'm interested in holding this thing flat, our operating costs as long as absolutely possible. But, you know, I'm open for, you know, all ideas to come to the table, and we'll see. But clearly we have structural problems within our oil tax. We've had a federal tax change from what, 35 to 22 or something in that range. That moved significant cash around the table against the state. And then we have now one of the major partners up there with us in the oil patch is a non-C corporation. So that cash flow is all moved. So those two units alone, or components alone, would warrant a review to make sure that the system is as fair as it was, you know, before the Trump administration and he lowered the corporate income tax. That alone warrants a review. And it's got to be, it's a significant amount. How much, I have no idea, but it's certainly a significant amount. That needs to be on the table. I am not, just talking about my own opinion, I am not interested in legalizing gambling, and I'm not interested in legalizing prostitution to fix our problem. You know, so we'll see what comes to the table. We've got a few levers we can move, and until we get a solution, we need to hold our spending cap at 5% at all costs of the permanent fund. And we'll get a solution one way or the other. But once we breach the permanent fund and we loot $3 billion out of it, we're going to loot a lot more. I've seen it at this table with different members and different legislatures, and I know the attitude of the building. So I am very cautious, Mr. Chairman, moving forward. If there's one thing we need to do for the future of the state and the future of our descendants, give them an intact permanent fund. Do not spend all the wealth of the oil basin in our lifetime. So we'll be asking some more detailed questions as we go forward and trying to come up with a solution. And I would like, on a positive note, Mr. Chairman, to say things are getting better financially. Things look better going forward. I think, you know, we've definitely turned the corner, and we can work our way out of it. But other than that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be quiet for a while and I'll get on my high horse again a couple more times that day as my blood pressure goes up.
Well, we've got a doctor sitting right beside you. Problems. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barnhill, you know, I've known you for a long time. You've been around here for a long time. And you come with some pretty significant credentials that, with your degree in finance and whatever else from, you know, one of the fancy universities that's not even in the area. But I think I'd like to second, having been here with a number of people that were here, Senator Stedman in particular, Horton, we did have billions and billions of dollars put back into the permanent fund dividend. And then I was in the minority and he was not even on finance, and then it got spent. I guess my message to you, and I'm holding you responsible since you have the credentials, you've got the longevity, that this bridge funding is really a non-starter for $3 billion. And so I know of little or no support for that at this table. And so because of that, in the interest of time, especially with our time here during a special session when many of us want to be home, we need to think about some other avenue to go ahead and try and either close the budget gap or to try and find where we can get it someplace else, because I don't think it's going to come from the permanent fund. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson, thank you. Please continue with the slide 7.
So, Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, and I think we left off with me to just give a little discussion on what's happening in the world of endowments. So first, let me preface it by saying that every endowment should be managed with the objective of preserving the inflation-adjusted value of that fund over time. And the purpose of that is to protect the value of intergenerational equity so that the people that are the beneficiaries of that fund today have the same access as the people in the future or the beneficiaries will have. And the primary way endowments do that is to manage the spending so that the fund grows at least at the rate of inflation. There are literally hundreds of endowments and foundations in the United States, and the large majority of them follow a rule that's similar to the permanent fund. That's a 5% of a three-year rolling market average. What's happened over the past year and with the impact of COVID is that the needs that charities and endowments are challenged with have increased. And so a discussion has begun outside of the permanent fund, of course, about what can they do to increase spending when the need has increased. Now, I'm not going to suggest at all that there's a majority of funds that are increasing their spending rules. That's not what's happening. Over the past 5 years or so, the trend has been down. But in the context of COVID, there are endowments that have considered one-time increases. As the slide indicates, Harvard is one of those. They've increased to 7.5%. Entities like Common Fund are leading conversations with their member endowment organizations on how to look at their spending rules and how to balance the challenges of the present with the need to maintain sustainability in the future. So the only point I just want to make is that the 5% rule is being examined elsewhere, and there's critical attention being paid to, can we make one-time adjustments or limited-time adjustments in order to meet the huge challenges that the COVID pandemic has presented?
Senator Stedman, that didn't take long.
No. You can always justify spending money on the good of the public. There's no question that it can be justified. What it comes down to is the prudence of actually doing it. And you have to say no. And it's hard to say no. It's hard to tell people that you can't afford everything they want, but you just can't. And I'd like to just remind the table and also the Department of Revenue and everybody else, you know, we had robust markets in the 90s, and we had our PERS and TERS and our retirement system, and everything was fine. And everybody got fat, dumb, and happy because of strong markets, and they dropped their contributions and increased their benefits and rolled our pension plan upside down, shot it right out of the air. And we ended up with in excess of $10 billion in liabilities. I think back when we looked at rewriting it, it was around 5 or so, and we were hoping it would cap out at 8, and it accelerated way above $8 billion underwater. And now we've got, you know, some positive trends coming at us that'll help us get that out of the way. But I'd just like to remind the table, you play or you work with the long run averages of the financial markets. And if you skim off the top on your strong years, when you have your return regressing to the mean because you have crappy years, you are going to be hammered in your portfolio. So this is not like you're going to take $3 billion out, park it, let the market readjust and come in and buy in at a lower rate. You're taking it out and spending it. So I would just like to, again, remind the committee, whoever was sitting at the table at the time on the retirement boards, you know, took the action they took, and they rolled that retirement plan upside down, and the last presentation we had here, which is going to change with these robot markets, but they were talking about us making payments through the end of this century for that retirement plan, the end of this century. So Harvard, guys are a lot smarter than us. I know there's some Harvard graduates around, but so I'll exclude them. They're as smart as the other Harvard guys. But, and they may be, their endowments, you know, a lot older than ours, and their pockets are a lot deeper. But they don't have to go to the poor guy in the lunchbox going to work and tax his family if they mess up. They're all pretty wealthy people that back Harvard endowment. They're not the Alaskan citizens trying to feed their family. So I recognize that they may overspend their endowment. You know, so be it. They can do a call to their alumni and get fat right away. We have to go to our citizens who are having trouble feeding their family. So and I'm gonna protect our families first.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With all due respect to the senior co-chairman of finance, I'd like Mr. Barnhill to continue on with his lesson of the other endowments that, even though they're not like the Alaska's endowment, they've got it, certainly still have the principles that are there to go ahead, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about Harvard and the others.
Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill. Senator Olson, my presentation was finished,
okay.
But I would just emphasize that in all of these discussions, sustainability of the fund is a paramount consideration. It's the same here. We manage the needs of the present with the sustainability that protects the future.
Thank you. I mean, the commissioner said that early on. She says people rely on this dividend for basic needs. And I think you're hearing that around the table. We all want to get there. It's just how much arguing and jawboning we're going to do to get there and methodology. Thank you. Yes.
Through the chair, I just want to point out that the governor recognizes that there are all these different opinions, mm-hmm. and he recognizes that there's not just one way to make this work. And so he is really open to having the conversation about other ways to make this work. Mm-hmm. This is the starting point for the conversation. He recognizes we need a structural fix, you know, based on certain inputs and assumptions that, you know, we've developed and included in our model, you know, which we're going to start showing you here shortly. Mathematically, the model works. The discussion is more about the assumptions and the inputs and the philosophies of everyone sitting around this table in regard to how do we work our way out of this problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please continue. We got to start moving along here a little bit. We got another committee, I think, later today, Mr. Chairman.
So this is the first discussion where we get into the details of the model. And this is just a high-level view of how the budget gap would close with the inclusion of the $3 billion CBR deposit. So what the graph represents to the far left is the deficit that would need to be addressed through the CBR deposit of the $3 billion. And as you go through time, you can see the gap gets smaller, which is largely as a result of the growing POMV. And when we get to the year 26, 27, we begin to generate surplus revenues mm-hmm. and attain a balanced budget. So the next, I was just going to say, the next few slides now take this into different levels of detail, if you're ready to move to those slides.
Yeah, I've got a question, but it'll fit in nicely with slide 12 as well.
Okay. As we were developing our model and discussing how we could fix the fiscal gap, we recognized that having really strong reserves was critical to a sustainable model. And what this graph represents is what would the CBR look like into the future with the bridge funding only? And we have established in our model, in our approach, that we need strong reserves of at least $1 billion. And so the dashed line that you see going across the page represents the minimum balance of reserves that we need. And the area there that is circled, which is year 2024 and 2025, represents the time frame in which new revenue measures or additional reductions would need to occur in order for us to be sustainable. The way that we developed the $1 billion is as we looked at the composition of our revenues, the majority of which is POMV, which because it is established over it's smoothed over a rolling five-year average, it provides some near-term certainty in regard to our revenues. However, the oil revenues, which represent about 27% at least as we are currently sitting today, that does represent potentially volatile revenues just based on the global fluctuation of price. So we looked currently, we generate just about $1 billion of revenues for oil and gas. And so we established that reserve anticipating that it would enable us to cover, you know, probably like half of two different fiscal years, But should we experience some reductions in the price of oil with this amount of a reserve, we believe that it would enable the legislature and the governor to get together and act to develop other solutions to the situation.
Questions from committee members? Seeing none, please continue.
The next slide is a representation of our reserves that includes an additional $150 million in fiscal year 24 and an additional $150 million in fiscal year 25. And so you can see here on this graph that in every year we exceed the $1 billion minimum CBR balance that we believe we would need to have as a cushion to manage the unforeseen events that may happen.
Senator Stubman.
Again, you know, and we'll work on this issue, but I have a really hard time believing on these expenditure reductions. If we're going to reduce the budget, we need to do statutory changes. And is the governor going to bring forward statutory changes for us to reduce the agency costs? Because we've been unable to do it since the second year in the Walker administration. So, you know, I'd like to see some of the concepts. I'd like to see some of the target agencies. I don't believe it's deliverable without it. We can't do it. We need statutory changes. And we can, so I'd like to hear what their plan is to implement this stuff a little earlier than wait till, you know, that far into the future, if I could, Mr. Chairman.
August, right?
Pardon me?
August.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Stedman, the objective is that we talk about these solutions in the August timeframe. But additionally, to your point in regard to implementing solutions earlier, you know, I believe that to the extent that that could be done, I don't see that there would be any objection by the administration to do that.
Follow up, Senator Stedman?
The point is the legislature can't do it. We need help from the administration, whoever the governor is at the time. Here we had Walker and Dunleavy. We have four different legislatures and two different governors. So it needs to come forward from the administration so they can help us with all the agencies in the reduction. And it's going to take a few years to work through that, understand that, two or three years. But where are they? You know, hopefully we'll see them in August or October or sometime. But I'm getting the impression that they are not coming. And we know what they are. They're major categories. So anyway, we'll. I don't want to sound too cautious. But we spent a lot of time in the last 2 years at the table here doing a very transparent budget, taking out all the fund source changes and fund switching, so it's pretty clear to the legislature what we got on the table and where we're at. And we've got the data laid out by agency, and we're willing to work with the administration to solve the problem. But until we see specifics, and something that can be implemented and not added back into supplemental, you know, you're not going to have reductions. What you're going to have is taxes with a capital T, and only the people that work. As referenced earlier in the meeting, not all Alaskans have a job.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, again, just want to throw out here, every time we see $300 million, that number is actually $500 million. Is that correct? Just for transparency purposes for the public that may not follow along with the governor's tenure plan, and they're only looking at this presentation, that it's actually $500 million.
Through the chair, if you consider, as you were pointing out, Senator Wilson, the $200 million that was in the 10-year plan, that is correct.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Wilson.
Follow-up. What is your probability prediction on getting the legislature the information we need by August for that special session? We had 100% certainty that all proposals and plans be ready by August 1st. Or are we looking at 50%, 45%?
Through the chair, that is extremely difficult to answer because I am not sure what it is that you need in order to answer your questions. I mean, as we're sitting here today, we've identified some requests, which we will absolutely do. So to the extent that you have additional requests, that would be fabulous. In regard to, you know, all of the information that you need, I cannot identify a percent.
If I could just follow up with this, just a comment then. I mean, I think this is the fourth presentation to the legislature, or third, and I think some of the same questions and themes have come up. And so I was hopeful for, you know, not the exact same presentation that we heard earlier in this building, but maybe some joyful news that, hey, we heard the legislature speak upon these issues for the past couple of weeks. We are going to work on some of these issues. I know I'm just venting, Mr. Chair, but we need more to sort of have the fiduciary responsibility of the state of Alaska and to make better decisions and choices that could bring us out. I mean, I think that the earlier comments upon why the legislature didn't raid their fair share of the earnings in previous years is because we had other oil revenues coming into the state and we didn't need to use that. So it wasn't just that we had this wonderful foresight that later on we just had other revenues coming in. And so without seeing, you know, as Ms. the other co-chair presented out, we know where, you know, these large oil structures or other items of revenues could come in. And so, but we're all just sort of hanging around those concepts and not just throwing them out there and putting them on the table. I mean, obviously, there's either some tax structure changes in corporations that we could do. I mean, there's other oil tax changes credits, a barrel, I mean, reduction, sliders, fees. I mean, we all know that, but those processes in previous legislators have taken years to come up to concepts. It's taken over 20 years to get to a PMOV model. And so trying to change a major statute change or a major fundamental change and trying to do that within 30 days is going to be really hard and is a very heavy lift, if not impossible lift, without getting us started here, the sooner the better. So that's just my request, is the sooner that the information can be made available to the legislature so we can start considering these things, so we can start acting faster, it would be very beneficial for us to acting and getting these things out of committee so we can move forward of trying to fix this physical problem.
Thank you. No, Senator Von Imhoff, and then I believe Senator Wilikowski is behind her. So, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to just kind of build upon a little bit what Senator Wilson stated. So just to reiterate, we have approximately $300 million in revenues are needed, and there's about $500 million in reductions, so that's $800 million change. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is not correct.
Did you hear that, Senator Von Imhoff?
I did. It's not correct. So could Commissioner Mahoney provide the correct numbers of what's needed in terms of cuts and new revenue?
I'm through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. The 10-year plan in regard to the expenditure component of it included $200 million in reduction to the budget. That was used as the foundation for developing this new fiscal plan. So that was already baked in, if you will, to the numbers. So when we developed the plan here, looking forward, an updated plan, those numbers were included, but there was a recognition that we needed an additional $300 million to close the gap. So the $200 million in expenditures, as well as the $300 million in either expenditures or revenue, is a combined $500 million.
thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Please.
Okay, so I just want to make sure, I'm looking at a different set of numbers or different math, and here's how I look at it now, is when we're looking at the budget now, just what we're dealing with for fiscal year 2022, we nearly balance. I think with the capital budget of honor, about $200 million, I think we balance, like zero, and that's before paying a dividend. And that's with our current robust permanent fund and the POMB draw. As soon as we pay a dividend, and you can say whether it's a dividend first or whether it's education or whatever, but as soon as we add the dividend into it, the 18th agency, we begin to go into a deficit. With the governor's numbers, his proposals, my understanding is to take half of the POMB draw right off the top for the dividend. The draw at this time is about $3 billion. And that's with the full amount in there. There's no ad hoc draws. Half of $3 billion is $1.5 billion. So if we take $1.5 billion right off the top of revenue, we pretty much have a $1.5 billion deficit because we balance now. As we move forward, this deficit, whatever we set up, it's probably going to be pretty stable over time, because I don't think we're going to have huge market values of oil going up or down, simply because it's only 30% also of our revenue at this point. It doesn't have the same impact as it has previously. And because the permanent fund takes a five-year average of the previous 5 years market value, that smooths it out as well. I anticipate that the wide volatility, is those days are hopefully behind us. So why I'm saying that is that whatever we kind of put into place today, tomorrow, a year from now, probably will be pretty similar in the future. And previous OMB numbers have basically shown this. So to summarize, taking 50% of the POMB off the top is going to yield us about $1.5 billion deficit, however you cut it. And $300 million in taxes and $200 million in additional cuts will hardly scratch the surface. It will take many more millions in cuts and many more millions in taxes out of the producing economy in order to pay a dividend. And I think that I just don't understand how $500 million total can close the gap, especially when the previous information that the governor's office, the administration has produced, has shown otherwise. And I think that we'll see with ledge finance as well. Thank you.
Any more questions? Next slide, if we're ready for the next slide.
So, Mr. Chairman, this slide is a representation of the different types of revenues and as they grow through time, as well as expenditures, new revenues, and the draw. And I think once I go through this, it will help Senator Von Imhoff understand how we believe we can manage the deficits lower into the future. And just to summarize that right off the bat, the reason why we believe that can happen is because of the growth that we are anticipating of the POMV, which on this graph is reflected in orange. So let me just walk through it. The next slide provides the numbers that support this graph, but this is just a visualization. So the blue at the bottom represents our traditional revenues, which you can see just grow very small into the future. The revenues that really drive the success of the financial model are the POMV revenues, which you can see they grow pretty significantly over the time frame. And this is due to the significantly larger starting balance of the PERM fund. In our model, we started with a balance of $77 billion and grew it at 6.25%. As a result of that growth, that increases the POMV, which is what drives up the revenues that are able to reduce the deficits into the future. So the $1.4 billion that Senator Von Imhoff referenced in fiscal year 22 actually is reduced to $890 million in fiscal year 23, $451 million in fiscal year 24. So it goes down largely due to the increase of the POMV, assuming the 6.25% return. The yellow on the graph represents the CBR draw that is being proposed by the governor. And this is the $3 billion, and what it is depicted on this graph is it just shows how that would be used over a period of time to bridge us through these deficits that we anticipate. The gray area represents the new revenues or reductions that we anticipate would come into the picture beginning in fiscal year 24. The green line represents expenditures. So what this graph shows you then is we begin to be in a surplus situation beginning in fiscal year 27.
Commissioner, how much analyses did you put in this? Did you run a Monte Carlo scenario, and how many did you run a 10,000 assumption baseline? And
Mr. Chairman, we did run a Monte Carlo simulation. I believe it was 20,000 iterations, but I would like to confirm that with Mr. Dan Stickle, who did the iteration.
Is he online?
He is not. We can get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Additionally, Mr. Chairman, we did stress test the model. We ran several scenarios, several investment scenarios, several oil price scenarios, and we can show you the results of that as well if you would like at a later date. I recognize that we are short on time.
Thank you. Senator Stedman, did you have a question, sir?
Well, I'll wait till the next slide.
It's the data slide.
Slide
12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this next slide is the slide with the numbers. And so first of all, I would like to point out that mathematically, this model works. The difference between our model and Ledge Finance's model or any models that anybody else runs is really based on different assumptions and different inputs. Whoops, there we go. And what we've represented here are the governor's policies and his philosophy in terms of how we fix the structural deficit. As I mentioned earlier, the POMV in a 50-50 split environment is reflected here beginning in fiscal year 22 as 50% of the POMV. The budget of $4.6 billion represents the governor's proposed budget. You can see the constitutional budget reserve amount over time. If you look at it across the page, beginning in fiscal year 21 through fiscal year 2030, it grows from $1 billion to $2.3 billion, and it stays above our target of $1 billion throughout the model. This plan supports a 50-50 dividend for Alaskans that in fiscal year 22 are proposed at $2,354, growing to $3,000 in fiscal year 2030. But more importantly, what is reflected here in fiscal year 24 and in fiscal year 25 is the need for the new revenues and the reductions that we've continually referred to. So in fiscal year 24, we've identified additional revenues of $150 million, ramping up to $300 million in fiscal year 25. This also incorporates the bridge funding at the end of fiscal year 22, which is the reason why you would see the CBR balance go up, because with that deposit, it addresses the deficit, and then it continues to address the gaps in the future. Also, the model, if you look at the very last line, it assumes a starting point for determining the POMV of a fiscal year-end 21 of $77.6 billion of the permanent fund. As likely many of you know, this week the permanent fund was at $81 billion. So when we update this model next, we will be using the June, the end of the fiscal year, June balance to recalculate what the POMV revenues would be in the future, which if it remains at $81 billion, what that means is there's upside in those revenues. They would likely begin to increase due to the increased starting point. So with that, I'll take just...
Commissioner, before... Mr. Chairman, I got this right on my brain here. So correct me if I'm wrong, because I probably heard this wrong, but really you're only asking to draw $2 billion out of the ERA, and you're going to count the $1 billion as the PCE to get you to the three?
The net effect to the permanent fund is $1.92 billion in regard to a reduction, which we show that on the next slide. Mm-hmm. We would draw three to enable fiscal sustainability, but we would deposit one, so the net is $2 billion reduction in value to the fund.
Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, we have been beating on that dead horse, but he ain't quite dead yet, so hang on here. Got a couple of things I think we need to work on. And I would grant it that, you know, in the beginning of this process, we need to get our models lined up, administration and ledge finance, and we'll work on that. But a couple of things that concern me, you know, when we look back, and I've again beat on this poor dead horse on flat budget since 17, the second year of Governor Walker, and we've been running pretty much horizontal since then. And struggling for budget reductions. But then this 10-year plan runs all the way out to 2030. It would, in effect, be a pretty much a flat budget, starting at $4.5 billion in 17, ending up at $4.6 billion in 2030. I don't see how you'd accomplish that. I have a lot of concerns about that. That's a long time of a flat budget, and every year, Mr. Chairman, we get salary increases across the agencies. We have contract negotiations. We have all these built-in pressures pushing everything up. In fact, we had two amendments a couple of days ago. We're trying to figure out what to do with them in this budget cycle. So I really take a flat operating budget for 13 years with the biggest grain of salt I can swallow. So I'll work on that. And we'll get into that in more detail and when we run these models and try to check, and I'd like to check by agency when we do some of these forecasts. But also I got a little bit of concern because one thing I just don't know is the permanent fund ending balance, it looks pretty linear, but the market returns we know are not linear. We're using the 6.5, I guess, in this model, or you can use 6.25, whatever you want to use. But clearly there's decades of strong markets and there's decades of weak markets. And we're coming out of a fairly strong market for several years. So it's likely we're going to have some crummy markets coming at us. So when we do these models, I'd like to have some adjustments with real market returns and take a look at, you know, what we could expect if things aren't as rosy as we'd all like, because if we can't get the budget reductions and our tax increases, we're backed into the liquidating the permanent fund. And if it's constitutionally protected, then we have to go in and hammer the citizens with a huge, unbearable tax burden. If you can't reduce your operating budgets, you pay the bill. You have to make your payroll. So I'm really concerned that we avoid setting us up a trap 4 or 5 years out where the next governor walks in with no ability to access any revenue. All her savings are gone, and he's got upward pressure that he can't control or she can't control on the operating budgets. And we just have to go to our citizens and start taking out revenue out of their back pocket so we can make our payroll. So it's...
Commissioner, if you want to respond, then I have a question for you.
Yes, through the chair. Mr. Sedman, or Senator Sedman, you raise a really good point, and you raised several of them. In regard to the operating budget, there are some ebbs and flows, if you will, of just the normal costs associated with debt through the years. Also, it should be important to note that the tax certificates, the liability associated with that, reduce and then fall off in fiscal year 27. But in August, when we talk about this, I think it would be important that Mr. Steininger, the budget director, go through the details of that budget. He has done that in other committees, and I think that was helpful for folks to understand how those numbers were developed. We could do that today if there was time, but that would be up to you, Mr. Chair.
We're running a little tight here on time because we've got other work to do. So. Just could you have Mr. Stickle forward us the failure rate, Monte Carlo analyses,
yes,
assumptions, how many times you ran them, and the failure rate? And just to close to Senator Stebbins' point, we haven't even talked about the capital budget yet. And I'm looking at the beginning of 2021, and I'm looking at 2030, and I just respectfully disagree that we're way light on our budget number here when we start talking about a capital budget, because we don't even come close to making the 1% replacement rule for the deferred maintenance for the assets of the state of Alaska. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, are we done with this slide?
If you're done, I'm done.
Okay. It's important to note that when we develop forecasts, we understand that it is just a forecast. There is absolutely a recognition that there will be problems, that there will be events that will occur that will cause the numbers to be wrong. But we just wanted to point out that we recognize that there are upside fiscal benefits that we did not monetize and incorporate in our model. And likewise, there is downside risk, as Senator Sedman pointed out, that also is not incorporated in the model. For example, in regard to some of the upside, our retirement funds have also performed phenomenally. And as a result, their balances are way up. And so it may be that after we have our actuarial analysis, that there could be a reduction to the state contribution rate relating to those retirement funds. So that represents an upside in that it would be a reduction of our expenditures. Also, there's no federal stimulus money. I want to make that clear in our numbers. And so to the extent anything is used as revenue replacement for these years, what that does is it just increases our CBR balance. There's lapsing funds that that occur that are not incorporated in these numbers for fiscal year 21. And also there's, I think you all are aware that the governor's philosophy is to continue to look for opportunities to reduce the budget. And then also our model assumes a 6.25% investment return. We couldn't be more blessed, I guess, if the perm fund and the markets continue to perform better. And so there is always that potential. But additionally, there is downside risk, and we recognize that. We recognize that right now we are experiencing inflation that is significantly higher than what we have incorporated in the model. But based on, comments from our federal chairman, Jerome Powell, he indicates it's transitory. At the time that we update the model again and we work with you on it in August, if we believe that assumption in regard to inflation should be changed, we will change it. Also, if there's a market correction, as Senator Sedman has pointed out, that could reduce the value for our POMV revenues, as well as the contribution, or it would increase that contribution in regard to the retirement, failure to realize the downside pressure on the budgets, and then also just oil price and volume volatility. I mean, we are not naive to any of these. We recognize that it is a forecast. It's the starting point for our conversation. You know, and this is something, this represents the governor's philosophies, and we are just, we are really open to working collaboratively with this group.
Please continue.
The next slide is a representation of what the POMV impact would be as a result of the $2 billion draw. It would be the $3 billion draw, but with the PCE as a deposit, the net would be $2 billion. We recognize that the POMV over time would be lower, and so we are just being very transparent here in terms of identifying what that fiscal impact is. The graph to the right just represents the change in the PERM fund ending balances. So you can see there in fiscal year 22, you can see the impact of the governor's proposed $3 billion draw. And what we've done is we've reformatted our graphs to align more with Ledge Finance, so it's so that you all can look at them quicker and get your perspectives. And lastly, I know we want to wrap up. This is just a summary of the governor's plan, and I won't go through that because I've already mentioned all of it before.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any further questions from the committee before we move to the next part of the presentation? We're going to take just a brief of these for 1 second. Nobody go anywhere. Mr. Painter, we're going to abbreviate our agenda here. Mr. Milks will be off the hot seat for now. We're going to bring Mr. Painter up, see how we get along here.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and take us through this presentation, please.
Thank you. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. So I was asked to review the governor's fiscal plan and SJR 6, and before I get to that, I'm going to start by reviewing the Legislative Finance Division's own baselines so we have kind of understand what we're comparing the governor's plan to. So we'll remember back to the very beginning of session in January. We presented in the overview of the governor's budget two budget baselines. There was the current law baseline and the current policy baseline. The intent with these baselines is to provide a neutral starting point for the year's budget discussions, separate from any policy choices made in the governor's request. The idea was that we could have this baseline and compare the governor's request to it to see what policy choices the governor was making. Our fiscal modeling is very similar to that. It's based on versions of the FY22 budget that are very similar to those baselines and follows the same principles. It's designed to show policymakers the longer-term impact of the choices made in various plans. So our baseline assumption for our fiscal modeling is essentially that today's budget levels and the fiscal year 22 budget are maintained into the future, adjusted for inflation. So on the revenue side, our baseline assumption is to use the Department of Revenue's spring revenue forecast. And that revenue forecast uses $61 oil in FY22. It then grows with inflation in future years. The Department of Revenue's forecast is based on the Department of Natural Resources oil production forecast. That forecast projects that North Slope production will go from 459.7 thousand barrels per day in FY22 up to 565.5 thousand barrels per day in FY30. And then for the permanent fund, similar to what Department of Revenue just presented, we're assuming actual FY21 returns through the most recent statement, which at this point is April 30th, and then Callan's 6.2% assumption for FY22 and beyond. On the spending side for agency operations, we're actually using this committee's first committee substitute, the operating budget, as our baseline. And the reason behind that is something that Senator Sedman articulated earlier, and when that budget was rolled out. That budget did not include one-time fund sources that had been present in other versions of the budget, and it did not include a lot of the kind of budget maneuvers to make the budget look smaller. So it represents a good starting point going forward without a whole lot of policy variation. And that number is actually very close to our current law and current policy scenarios from back in January, but we felt using this was a little more updated because it represents something close to this year's actual budget. For statewide items, our baseline is to assume that all items are funded to their statutory levels. So that includes school debt reimbursement, the REAA fund, the Regional Education Attendance Area Fund, community assistance program, oil and gas tax credits, and the permanent fund dividend. In the case where we're modeling the governor's fiscal plan, we're assuming the PFD level outlined in that plan, the 50-50 of the percent of market value draw. We also have a baseline fund transfers amount that represents kind of the ongoing baseline of that, which is the cost of the spill prevention and response program, which goes through fund transfers. The capital budget, again, going back to this committee's work, we're assuming the Senate's first committee substitute, which was essentially the governor's budget from back in February, growing with inflation. And again, that represents kind of a baseline without one-time fund sources. Currently, the governor's amended budget since then, as well as both bodies' versions of the capital budget, are higher than that. So this may be kind of a conservative starting point, but we felt that it was a good idea of a baseline versus, you know, what we may end up at. And then for supplementals, we're assuming $50 million per year. That's based on the average amount of supplemental appropriations that we've seen from FY16 through 20, so the last 5 years, minus any lapsing funds. So trying to, you know, get the idea of what's the difference between our budget when we leave, when the governor signs it, and where do we end up in actual spending at the end of the year. The average over the last 5 years is actually $59 million, so we just rounded that down to 50. Seeing no questions, we'll talk about the governor's 10-year plan and how that compares to our baseline. So the governor's 10-year plan for the budget makes several policy choices to try to reduce spending. So there's 50% funding for school debt reimbursement and the REAA fund. That's consistent with the governor's FY22 budget request. Both bodies of the legislature this year funded that at 100%, and that was reflected in the actions taken by the conference committee so far. The governor's 10-year plan also has $65.7 million in less in UGF agency operations in FY22 than the original Senate budget. Some of that is actually consists of one-time fund source changes utilizing ARPA funds that in the OMB 10-year plan are reversed in subsequent years. So it's, while that's $65.7 million this year, the ongoing impact of that is a little less. But there are some policy choices that the governor made to reduce the budget that are not necessarily reflected in the baseline. The governor is also proposing $100 million in additional reductions in each of FY23 and 24. And the governor then grows in subsequent years the agency operations lower than inflation at 1.5%. And one thing I'd note is that those $100 million reductions are also do not take into account inflation in those years. So it's $100 million below the previous years. So in effect, you're not growing with inflation and cutting $100 million. So it's a bit of a compounding effect. And then they assume that supplementals and LAPs will balance out rather than have the $50 million assumption that we do. There's a handout that I believe is in your packet entitled the OMB and LFD Fiscal Model Assumption Comparison, and that just lays out the difference between our baseline assumptions and the OMB 10-year plan item by item, so it's really easy to see the difference in the comparison. And if there's particular items you have questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I think given the time, I'll just let you peruse that on your own time. And so just to emphasize, you know, this level of budget reduction is not necessarily unattainable technically, but these are significant policy choices. There have been annual debates in the legislature about how to fund school debt reimbursement and REAA fund and so forth and other items. It certainly is not just the default or the baseline to assume that these reductions would happen. It's going to require some policy effort. So this next slide, slide six, compares the governor's 10-year plan to our baselines. The negatives reflect where the governor's baseline or governor's 10-year plan is below our baseline. Positives, and which are just in FY 22, reflect where the governor's 10-year plan is higher. And so on that first line, agency operations, that's where the bulk of the difference is. So there's the $65.7 million in the first year. That grows a little over the next couple of years with those $100 million reductions versus our assumption of growth with inflation. And then that continues to grow with inflation over time because of the difference between not only the lower base with those reductions, but then also the different rate, so the 2% versus 1.5%. All told, between FY22 and FY30, that's a $3.1 billion difference in total spending just in agency operations. So that's by far the largest area where the governor is proposing reductions. The next largest would be statewide items. The governor's numbers are about $1.1 billion below our baseline. Much of that is reflected due to the 50% funding of school debt reimbursement and the REAA fund, as well as reduced funding for community assistance in the first couple of years of that plan. Part of the difference is also just kind of a technical difference in retirement funding. The governor is using the official ARM board numbers. We're using their draft from December that are a little higher. They will meet next week and adopt the official version so I would assume that after that we'll match up again. So that's really not a policy difference. It's really just a technical difference on the timing of when they took their numbers. On the capital budget, it looks like there's a question.
Wait till you're done.
So on the capital budget, the governor's total capital budget after GovAmend ended up being higher by $56.5 million. And then in subsequent years, they're using $150 million growing with inflation. We are using the $176 growing with inflation. After FY22, we agree on fund transfers, and then there's the difference in supplementals that I mentioned before. So in total, you can see that the difference between our baseline and where the governor's spending numbers is relatively minor in the first couple of years, grows significantly as those cuts compound. And in total over this period, the governor is proposing $4.856 billion lower spending than our baseline of today's budget growing with inflation.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's hard to get out 10 years with any forecast and any accuracy, and no matter who's doing it. So if you just look at, say, FY25, that's what, $591 million spread? So maybe the actual spread, Mr. Chairman's half of that, it'd still be $300 million we'd have to make up, which is significant. So we'll have to, as we go forward, the next few months, kind of work on some of these issues. And I'd like to also add, Mr. Chairman, and request to Ledge Finance that when we do some of these more in-depth presentations, like on agency operations, we've got them broken down by department. And maybe we can get some growth, and it'd be kind of a busy slide, but we can get some of these agency growth rates and statewide growth rates. Because when they talk about, or anybody talks about, 100 million, 200 million, 300 million in reductions in the agencies for unrestricted general funds, I'd like to have them tell us where they're going to be, because we've all struggled at the table on every single agency.
So. And we'll be struggling here in a little bit.
Yeah.
on some more reductions, and they're not $100
million. Please continue.
So this next slide is a version of our fiscal model that shows the effect of just the permanent fund side of the governor's plan without the spending reductions and without the new revenue. To illustrate the importance of those two items to pay for the plan. So I think everybody in this committee is familiar with how our model works, but for those in the public, the top left shows the lines which are spending assumptions, the bars are revenue sources. The bottom left shows our reserves. You can see that the ERA, which is in green, disappears, and that's because we assume the constitutionalization of the permanent funds. There's no more ERA. There's no separate fund. The top right shows the PFD check, comparing it to the statutory dividend currently. Below that is the permanent fund itself and its growth. You can see that it does grow significantly faster than inflation compared to FY21. The FY20 balance, and that's because of primarily the large market returns in this current year. And then the next one shows the impact of that $3 billion draw on the POMV that shows that essentially taking $3 billion extra out of the fund causes something like a $150 million reduction in POMV over time as that's worked into the average. And so what this slide demonstrates is that if you just do the 50-50 dividend and the bridge funding, you run out of the bridge very quickly, and we have in the top what we refer to as a broken model. When the lines and bars don't match up, that means that there's not enough funds to pay for the budget, and that's because we have persistent deficits that can't be filled. And so that's, again, this is not the governor's full plan. This is just the permanent fund part, and then the next slide will show with the governor's assumptions built in.
Please continue.
So slide 8 shows the same permanent fund plan, but then adding the governor's spending plan and adding the $300 million in new revenue. And these numbers here are actually very, very close to what the governor's own model shows. I think we have a very slight difference in the growth rate in the permanent fund, but it's within a few million dollars. So I think this shows that the differences between what our modeling presents and what their modeling shows is really just a matter of their policy choices. And so this shows, similar to what the Revenue Commissioner just presented, that we would go from deficits to surpluses and that we would retain a CBR balance throughout this period and then begin to rebuild it as the surplus is deposited into there. So I think this model demonstrates that if you can make the reductions and bring in the new revenue, the governor's plan, the numbers presented there do work.
That's assuming a 1.5% inflation rate, 50% school bond debt, REAA reduction from what we have today in the budget, et cetera, et cetera. These are the gov's numbers in the middle column.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So, you know, again, the items within those governors, the plan, I think we've gone over that in a couple of presentations now, so I won't reiterate, but, you know, the OMB 10-year plan for spending, which is significantly lower than our baseline, new revenue, the constitutionalized PFD at 50% of the POMV draw, transferring the PCE fund to the permanent fund, and making power cost equalization a constitutional mandate, and then that $3 billion of bridge funding.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I just thinking back on the permanent fund, and we were talking about taking $2 billion out of the permanent fund and liquidating the PCE, Power Cost Equalization Fund. So why would you would be just, in essence, I guess, transferring the payout to the permanent fund. You're liquidating and spending the PCE endowment.
Senator Sedman, so in our models and the administration's model, we switched the PCE program to a UGF expense, and that adds to the spending in those years, as well as the community assistance program, which is currently primarily funded with the PCE program. That would now become a UGF expense with this transfer.
Please continue.
Okay, going on to slide 10. So, again, our modeling and the governor's modeling don't have significant technical differences. The numbers they're presenting are technically sound. The question for the legislature is whether you agree with the policy choices in the plan and whether you think they're achievable or not. So right now, the legislature has four main levers to use to balance the budget. You can draw from your savings accounts, including the ERA, although that we've only done that following the POMV. We could reduce the PFD, we could reduce the budget, or we could increase revenue. The governor's plan essentially removes those first two options, leaving only the last two. So you could no longer reduce the PFD, and we could no longer draw additional money from the ERA, although if we did rebuild savings, that would be an option. However, over the past 9 years of deficits, we've essentially run out of those other savings sources. And we've, over this period, used three of the four levers. We've used budget reductions extensively. We've used PFD reductions and have not paid the statutory amount on that. And we've drawn from our savings. We have not significantly increased revenue. So going forward, I think there's really those same options absent the governor's plan. The $3 billion bridge funding allows for time for the increases to existing revenue sources and the new revenue and the spending reductions to balance the budget while paying a 50-50 PFD. If you adopted all of the governor's plan elements other than the bridge funding, the CBR would not have sufficient funds to avoid an ERA overdraw during the transition period. The CBR, with its current balance, is not enough to get us through that transition period. So that's why, for the administration's plan to work, that $3 billion is an essential component to get us to their balanced budget with their other policy choices.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could have Ledge Finance come back. I'm concerned about the opportunity cost of the $3 billion overdraw or looting of the permanent fund. And I'd like to see a growth projection on that $3 billion going forward for 30 years and the payout that would come out. We can see how much it's going to cost our grandchildren. If we can have that done, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you. Sure, yes, we can provide that. And, you know, our rule of thumb is essentially that using the 5% POMV, every $1 billion you take out of the permanent fund reduces the POMV by $50 million. So that $3 billion transfer, just kind of a rule of thumb, would increase or reduce the POMV by $150 million in real terms. Obviously, there's the five-year average and the lag and so forth. So, you know, it takes a while for that to take effect, but that's sort of our rule of thumb to get that impact. So to evaluate a fiscal plan, it requires clear goals and metrics to determine what problems are we trying to solve. In the Department of Revenue's slides, they showed the governor's goals. I think the legislature may need to explicitly state what your goals are in designing a fiscal plan. Making that explicit will make it easier to evaluate different plans because, as the governor has mentioned and as many legislators have said, there are many ways we could approach this, but the success of them will depend on what goals you're trying to solve. So an example of that would be that some people may have the goal to balance the budget at current oil prices. Some people would say that current oil prices in the $60 range are high enough that we should try to generate surpluses to rebuild the CBR so that if prices go down, we would have sufficient savings to weather that. And so depending on whether you think today's prices are where we should aim or not, that's going to make a big difference for how much you know, spending reductions and revenue increases you would need to make a plan work. Another question would be, is it more important to avoid taxes or specifically broad-based taxes or to have distributional equity, meaning that people throughout the income distribution are impacted evenly by the plan? That's been a discussion we've heard a lot in the legislature and in the public is, you know, is are certain options regressive or progressive, and is there, for ideological reasons or other reasons or economic growth reasons, reasons to avoid broad-based taxes? You know, the governor said that the goal is to avoid broad-based taxes, and so there's $300 million of revenue, I guess, does not include that. Others would say that a broad-based tax is okay. I think that's just resolving that conflict would be important to trying to have a plan you can get a majority behind. Another is it important to maintain downward pressure on spending, or have we cut too far already? There was some discussion in the other body with a similar presentation about various spending needs of the state. We could point to deferred maintenance and other items where there's substantial spending need to have a debate about whether, you know, maintaining that downward pressure is important, or if we've already reached that point where that's no longer really possible. And so just that those differences are going to make it difficult to say whether a fiscal plan works or doesn't from a policy standpoint, because the answer will be different to different people. And then I'll just leave you with some questions, which can be rhetorical unless anybody wants to answer. But there's a few questions that I think are important for the legislature to establish answers to. One is, which elements of a plan should be constitutional and which should be statutory? Is it important to set a new dividend formula in the Constitution, or could a new dividend formula be in the statute? Should PCE be in the Constitution, or should it be statutory? Do we need a new constitutional spending limit, or is a new statutory limit sufficient? There's a lot of differences of opinion about what needs to go constitutionally in the future versus what can just be statutory changes. And then another question would be, if the legislature does not agree with the governor's spending reduction plan, should the difference be made up with more revenue or with lower PFDs than the governor's plan? You can flip that around and say, if the $300 million of revenue is too optimistic, should we make that up with lower PFDs or with lower spending? And same with even the dividend. And then another question is, if or when oil revenue declines substantially in the future, will this system still be sustainable, either this one proposed by the governor or whatever the legislature eventually adopts? If you're putting something in the Constitution, you may want to consider the time period beyond oil. Oil is not an infinite resource. And then finally, would the voters approve this constitutional amendment? And sorry, I left the House numbers in here still, but it would be SJR 6 rather than SJR 7. And what about the spending limit proposal from the governor, or the proposal for voter approval of taxes? And if you are all of these different measures necessary for the governor's plan to work, or can you pick and choose some of them as you prefer? And with that, I will leave it there and happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Seeing none, that will conclude today's meetings. I want to apologize to Mr. Milks and Law. We just ran out of time here today, and we'll have you back before us at some point in the future. This concludes today's meetings, and we don't have any further hearings scheduled this time. Anything else before we adjourn today, gentlemen? We're adjourned at 3:40.